Welcome to another episode of the Vikingology podcast.
The art and science of the Viking Age.
I'm CJ Adrian, co-host number one.
And I am Terry Barnes, co-host number two, formerly Thing Two. Been a while since that one.
Oh yeah, thing one, thing two. And
Right.
today, our lovely guest is
Us!
just us.
The best guest of all. I actually have my students who are doing, the book project that they do, and they have to suggest titles for our book. And I had a student just the other day send me one. Y'all gonna love this. See, so that's the way I feel about this
Your
podcast.
student didn't come up with that, their dad did.
No, actually, and then
Oh,
I wrote him back, and because he wrote insert Texas accent here, and so then I wrote him back, and I'm like, oh, I love this because I'm going to be in Texas in a couple of weeks visiting some friends, and then he goes, yeah, my girlfriend loved it; she couldn't stop laughing. He goes, I was so proud. So yeah.
yeah.
Anyway, maybe that's the way we feel about this podcast. Y'all gonna love this.
Y'all gonna love it. Oof. Oof. We're starting the dad jokes early. Hang on. I officially need this.
You need So there's some Viking stuff though to talk about, I think, that I've seen. Well, I sent you that Harper's article that my friend sent me today about the intersection between Vikings and weird modern things happening.
Yeah.
Maybe we could post that in the notes. I don't know. There's another thing too that I was going to ask you about that somebody we both follow on Instagram. She made reference to this phrase, which I don't think I've ever heard before, but I find interesting. Viking washing. So
Viking washing. All
when
right.
you
Enlighten me.
Viking wash stuff, meaning you make it, try to make it as Viking as possible, I guess, is what that is. But it was a post where she was I think kind of calling out some modern day heathen people for, maybe trying to get their Viking on too hard or something, and going for all that, authenticity and stuff, and so that they're Viking washing what they're doing in order to sort of make it seem more Viking, I guess. I don't know, but I kind of liked that phrase. I was wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, like the over the top representation. So if I'm a reenactor, I'm like, I'm going to do everything that's historically, accurate. That's air quotes, right? And then have jewelry that's a Thor's hammer and a Valknut and a Raven banner and a thing, and basically have it all, even though those things weren't all found together on the same person, right? So it's essentially they're Viking washing. So they're using everything they learned on the internet and then putting it all together into one thing, and then therefore creating some kind of caricature, is how I imagine that going. Yeah.
I mean, I guess so. That's me too. That's where my brain went, was kind of that authenticity sort of, the holy grail of authenticity and all of that. But then I was thinking about too, like my friend who's an economist, and they use a phrase. I mean, he's not the only one, but they use a phrase in economics of like greenwashing the economy. And the greenwashing is the whole, basically, getting into your realm of marketing, where it's like, now people, corporations understand that if they sort of tout, how green they are in various ways, that it actually is good for the bottom line. So it's sort of this greenwashing of the economy. So I don't know if
Yeah,
that's,
that whole certified B corporation stuff. Yeah.
that kind of stuff. So I don't know. Viking washing, is it the same way? Is it maybe kind of a pejorative thing to say you're Viking washing something? I guess a little bit. Yeah, making fun of them, kind of.
It's a judgment, I think, for sure.
So I
Is
don't
there, is there, I mean, is there a harm really in it?
No.
I don't, I just wonder about that. Like greenwashing, I get, right? Because then you're putting out rhetoric that's disingenuous, misleading, damaging, right? It needs to be called out. But with a reenactor who's maybe wearing a few too many pieces of jewelry, it's
I don't
cosplay.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's interesting too. Like, why people even want a Viking wash? I mean, why? I mean, Vikings are interesting, but I don't know. Is it that big of a deal? Like, still? I don't know.
Yeah, it's not just the Vikings though, because I see it with medieval reenactment. I see it with Roman reenactment. We see it with Civil War reenactment.
Right.
That's an interesting one.
Oh, Civil War. Yeah. I used to, back in the day when I would teach an intro to like methods and skills history class, and I had my students read a little piece by, what was the guy's name? Tony something. His name is escaping me, but it was called Confederates in the Closet. It was this really great, funny article that this guy wrote. It was a journalist who embedded himself with some of those Civil War reenactors, you know, just to try to figure out, you know, what was going on there. But some of the things, the lengths of which he was saying that they were going, you know, to like really, you know, basically going on these hardcore diets to starve themselves so that they could actually really authentically sort of replicate bloated corpses on the battlefield, and soaking the brass buttons of their coats in urine because urine was the only thing that they found that gave them just the right patina that looked like, you know, authentic Civil War buttons and things like that. It was like, wow.
Wow. Yeah, some people have too much time on their hands.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all need hobbies.
First world problems.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, speaking of that, though, my other piece of news that you may have seen, Viking related, is that Universal Orlando is building the next new big world that they're building that you can go and experience is the How to Train Your Dragon world.
Oh, great. That's
It's
fun.
Like a great big like Viking, you know, statues, of course, you know, idiots with horned
Is that
helmets,
Viking?
all that kind of stuff.
Can we just call it Norse inspired, you know? Kind of like the Rohirrim in Lord of the Rings, they're Norse inspired. Again, my air quotes. Yeah. Instead of calling them Viking, I don't feel like Viking is a good label for that.
You'd be surprised at how many of my students tell me that, you know, that's basically their basis for what they know about Vikings is through that movie, How to Train Your Dragon.
Ooh, that hurts a little. That hurts a little. I think this brings up a great topic, and maybe not fully today, but something that I've been exploring myself. In answering this question, I recently met somebody who her entire job is she's a consultant that helps people get TED Talks, big TED Talks. And I'm on the board of a nonprofit, and she is also on that board, and she helped the founder of that nonprofit get this big TED Talk in San Francisco. It was a huge deal, and she's very good at what she does. And I asked her about how many TED Talks she's seen about history, this sort of thing, and she looked, you know, and she knows about my background a little bit. She's like, well, you know, could we do a TED Talk on Vikings? She's like, you'd have to come up with a topic where it's not about the Vikings, but about why it's important that we examine them. And off the cuff at that moment when we were talking about it, I drew a blank. As I had a long day, I couldn't think. I just need to go home and sleep. I have a 6 month old now. At the time he was 6 weeks old, so we
Would you?
were but this was recent, and so I've spent a lot of time thinking about what is it about the Vikings that's interesting. And I think about my own experience engaging with this topic. And when I first got into it, I had no interest in the Vikings. My interest was in the early medieval period, and the Vikings just happened to be an active player within that broader context. Then when I started exploring the Vikings, what I encountered was this interesting hiccup in history. Every history class I'd ever taken, every book I'd ever read said, this is, you know, on the Romans, on the Carolingians, it's always, this is the established consensus fact, blah, blah, blah. You learn it, you memorize the facts, dates, it's pretty cut and dry, it's history. With the Vikings, it always ended up being, like, for example, a really good writer, his last name was Florinsky. He's a historian on early Russian, actually general, just he wrote a couple of general volumes on Russian history, and he had a small segment on the Vikings, and his whole spiel at the beginning was, this is what we think we know, but we don't actually know it, so we're just going to ignore it. And I remember seeing that and being like, this is weird. So I went to my university advisor, and so what I encountered with the Vikings, I think, is a mystery not just of who were the Vikings exactly, but also, what are all of these strange mythologies that have cropped up around them, and why them? And I think my entire journey has been trying to figure out, well, what is it about that? Like, for me, I'm interested in the Vikings because I want to figure out what's interesting about them that's caused them to become such a cultural phenomenon. It's not the Vikings themselves that are really that interesting, although I do, once we get into the weeds, I do find it interesting. But like, and also it's such an interesting exploration of how we as a culture engage with the past. As a history teacher, I went into school to become a history teacher specifically,
Right.
and understanding what makes my student ticks, or what makes my students tick. What is it about history that would make it more engaging for them? And in the Vikings, I found this odd, but here was the problem. There's this odd fiction revolving around it, where everyone accepted these fictions as absolute fact about the Vikings.
Right.
But no one actually knew, no one, or back then, no one knew anything. And even to this day, most, the vast majority of people don't have a clue. And they just think, oh, well, because the horns are everywhere, it must be true.
Right.
Right? Or because this is everywhere, it must be true. And so it's, I don't know. There's, so in thinking about that TED talk, I'm wondering, like, is that the path? Are the Vikings perhaps the best example of how engaging with the past can go wrong?
Yeah.
And we can even look back at World War II, because the Vikings were co-opted by the Nazis, for example. And even
Right.
before then, they were co-opted by various groups, right? It's starting in the 19th century,
Right.
Wagner, right? And so the these fictions that grew up around them. So it's, you know, I think it's a complicated question. I don't have all the answers now, but you know, I it's been, you know, I don't accept that I'm interested in the Vikings just because I'm intrinsically interested in the Vikings. I'm interested in why the Vikings have become what they've become today. And I'm also interested in figuring out, but what is the objective truth, so that we can figure out where the gulf is. And then maybe in that gulf, we can understand how they've become what they are today. Do you see where I'm going with this?
No, absolutely. Because I think we even, in our previous podcast with Claire, we talked about that a little bit. I mean, that's what has drawn me to them as well for the last dozen years or so is, I mean, I'm trained as a medievalist. My graduate work is in medieval history, and I definitely prefer the pre-modern world as an area of just intrinsic interest to me. But the Viking thing started to become a thing, right? Arguably in more recent times with the History Channel's show, and then it just kind of keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. And I've always been interested in same thing as you, like, well, why do we engage in the past in the way that we do, and to what ends? And that whole like the gulf that you were just describing, I mean, to me, that's the perfect part about it. I mean, people, human beings have always played with history. It's not something that's a modern phenomenon. But that we, I think that for a lot of people, whether they even actively know it when they're doing it or not, the part of the issue that historians know about Vikings as far as the source issues that can only take us so far, that it does leave this gulf, and then that's fun for people, right? That's the cosplay part, we were talking about. That's where, then we can insert ourselves, and all of our wildest dreams and fantasies about who these people were can come true. I mean, I think on some level it's just simple entertainment slash escapism. In other ways, I think people look for certain things in the past to validate things that they hold dear now. And I'm always banging on about the whole Shield Maiden thing, but that's, to me, that seems to be a very good example. When you've got, sort of modern women in the Western world who like the idea of, equality between the sexes and strong women who can basically, hold sway with men in every sort of aspect of life and blah, blah, blah. Well, for some reason, they've imprinted that on the Viking Age, even though that actually is something we know about the Viking Age. It was not some egalitarian paradise, far, far from it. And there probably were a few shield maidens, but like not any sort of normal course. Like this wasn't like a job description that, all girls could aspire to or something. It just wasn't part of that world. And yet, but it's because of who we are and what we want women to be. So we just sort of latch on to this trope, right? And make it be real. And like you were saying earlier, it's like, so what's the harm in that, really? I don't know. I just always like, as a historian, I want to understand those people on their own terms, you know? So for me, that's, you know, for all of the sort of stuff that we like imprint ourselves on it, that's to me like just sort of adding these layers that kind of get in the way of that. And yeah, and although, you know, go ahead.
It does bring up the question, why the Vikings and not some other historic, you know, why not the Goths? Why not the Visigoths? Why not the Sarmatians? Why not, you know, there's, it, you know, Vikings specifically. So we see what, you know, like from the modern lens, we imprint, you know, we can imprint what we want on any time period in history. So why have the Vikings been singled out when, from a global historical perspective, they are they're a footnote. Honestly, I mean, I hate to say it, but they, I mean, it's a small period of time. It's a very small area. It's a very small impact. And we've talked about this throughout the entire podcast, is these were very small groups of people. And yeah, maybe they had a large impact compared to the size of their group. But globally, I mean, Genghis Khan caused an ice age, right? So right. You compare the Vikings to Genghis Khan, they don't measure up in any way. And so, so why the Vikings? Why this small, obscure group of people from Scandinavia in the three centuries preceding the high medieval period that we know very little about? What's interesting is recently I have been diving more into ancient history just for giggles. And specifically looking at the concept of the Celts. And now the Celts suffer from all sorts of problematic frameworks that come from the past, right? Like, is the term Celt even applicable? Can we even, you know, it, like there, and I took a course through the Great Courses, I forget the gal's name, and she talks about that, going back to like, could we even call these people Celts? Is the word Celt problematic? And she kind of dives into all those things, just like we dive into, is the word Viking problematic? And what's fascinating is the Roman Empire had this strange fascination with the Celts to the point where Celtic heroes and Celtic, you know, like the, you know, were famous gladiators. And, you know, like, and they would dress up with Celtic motifs just for giggles, you know, like they, and there was kind of a cottage industry around the Celts. Even though they had been conquered and subdued by the Roman Empire, there was this mythos of this indomitable people that were barbarians that threatened the empire. And I've been thinking a lot about that, of like the parallels between how the Romans engage with the Celts versus how we engage with the Vikings, for example, and trying to figure out where are the commonalities there, and what can we glean from that to inform us on how we're engaging with the past now? Because it seems to me this is what we're doing with the Vikings actually isn't a new thing. It's not original. The Romans had their own version of it. So I think there's something to be gleaned there. I'm not far enough along to draw any conclusions or anything like that, but I'm seeing a little bit of that opportunity where that's something I feel like I'm going to explore in the next couple of months, just because it's really interesting to see, well, how did the Romans engage with the past, right? But that's actually a question I ask myself when I write my books, is when I'm writing characters, I think about how do they engage with the past in their own time. That's a complicated question, one I don't always know the answer to. So in the books, it really comes out as they make some keen observations. They evoke mythologies that they may have heard in passing. Like Hastings, he sees the old Roman road, and then somebody tells him, well, there used to be this empire with the Romans, and they had towering golden cities and blah, blah, right? Like, it's just a total fabrication. So then he imagines this bygone era that was better than what they have now or in his time. And that's because I draw that parallel. I think that's identifiable for audiences today, because we often do the same thing.
Yeah.
Make America great again.
Yeah. Back to the Harper's article. I think, we also know that at least in England, you know, even just not that long after the end of the Viking Age, you know, there's primary sources about the English complaining that some of English people were trying to emulate Vikings, you know, like wearing their hairstyles and all of that, you know, sort of complain like, oh, we don't have any chance with the women because the women are all going for the guys that look like Vikings, you know, kind of stuff. And so it was interesting to them even then. But I think for us in the modern era, And, you know, you and I have talked about this, I think, a fair number of times with various guests, but just even ourselves, that, you know, the big elephant in the room is always the damn 19th century, you know, and that's close proximity to us. And so, you know, that's not that long ago. And it creates this entire sort of mythos around, you know, the whole Nordic thing. And you know, I just think that people latched onto it in various ways, obviously throughout the 20th century. And I think it's just still hanging on, and for ways that it did even 100 years ago, when early, you know, at least in the United States, due to the sort of the advent of early corporations discovering that Vikings sell, you know, and we're still doing the same thing now. But, you know, so that, whole, you know, in the nationalist vein of things and myth making and all of that, creating this sort of super interesting kind of superhuman group of people that everybody, you know, there's like, for Viking, I swear to God, you know, like, look at them, there's like something for everybody, you know, something to latch on to. If you like barbarism, they did that. If you like independence, they did that. You know, if you like adventurousness, you know, however you want to sort of spin essentially the same kind of theme, you know, it can seem like it's positive in some ways, negative in other ways, but like, you know, okay, everybody has something they can pick from it. And I think that's, you know, at least a large degree to why we kind of still do it. I don't know. I mean, it's really, you know, the whole romanticizing of it, I think, is just really interesting. Okay, so yeah, I was going to show you that that reel from Instagram that was, you know, started me thinking a couple of things about this. Here, let me share the screen. And I don't think it has sound. Oh, it does.
Oh, it has sound. I like that. Viking lifestyles, plural. So obviously it's fluid.
So see, Norsemen didn't have cell phones. They gathered in groups and talked amongst themselves. They didn't stare at a screen. They're the best shipbuilders ever. They didn't have software. Well, they didn't have a TV, so
yeah, there's no need to have to look at a television. Yeah, but they didn't have them, so how do you know?
Sometimes it's important. Sometimes it's important to look back at the space and time and basically go there, right? That's the very last line of this. And so then, you know, you could see what I chimed in here on my little giving my little two cents there. You know, I think it's, you know, an interesting thing to explore. Yeah, who doesn't like to sort of fantasize about, you know, living in other times and places, maybe where things are simple, you know, like you were just saying, and I've written about on my Substack. So the golden age is always somewhere in the past, right? So here it says, right, we're heading to a completely new space and time, so we can go backwards. But you know, knowing what we know about the Vikings, you know, who's to say that they wouldn't be staring at screens too? I mean, they seemed pretty damn adaptable, you know, and if it was going to, you know, benefit them somehow or they liked it, they would be doing it just the same way that we would. Don't you think? But
I think, you know, I'm translating my grandfather's memoir. It's a project I have on the docket. And the way he describes his village pre-World War II, I think he's born in 1936. It's exactly that. They would gather around a fire, tell stories. They didn't have screens. So you could take that, what they just said, swap out Viking for French people in 1935, or rural, I hate that word in English, rural French people in 1936, and you get the same thing. So what is this? Why the Vikings? Why are we singling them out? Like, you know, if you go back 30 years, everybody was living that lifestyle. Right? So it's just so odd. And then to your point, yeah, Vikings were, you have said this repeatedly throughout the podcast, Vikings are opportunists to the extreme. If they are presented with something that they perceive will be helpful, and they're quite entrepreneurial. So if they got a cell phone and you said, hey, by the way, people make a lot of money online, you're going to have online Vikings. Well, what do we call those? Hackers, right? Like, where they're just, you know,
exactly.
They'd be the first into crypto.
Exactly. You know, we'd be, what would we do? And then, like, creating an Instagram reel about how they were the best crypto creators of all time.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know. I mean, it is just, you know, it's common human thing to do. You know, I think it is, and people, especially, again, you know, sort of going to the dreaded 19th century. I mean, the modern industrial era, right? I mean, and so we live in a space and time that is demonstrably different. And so it makes it probably even more doubly so that we would be fantasizing about a pre-modern time when, you know, basically life is like camping every day, and you don't have all these distractions or whatever. But, you know, I mean, come on, like, let's. Okay, I had said I'm a medievalist and I'm interested in that in terms, you know, just inherently. So I'm probably as guilty of this as anybody else. But, you know, how do you romanticize like a life where, okay, you're going to live to be 40. So good luck. You know, you're already ancient. I'm long past dead. And we're, you know, we don't have antibiotics, so any little scrape can kill you. And if you're a woman, you know, the possibility of dying in childbirth is like seriously high, every time. And, you know, we're talking about Vikings in Scandinavia, the winters are bloody cold and terrible and dark, and, you know, food, I mean, just a subsistence farming life, you know, if we actually sat and thought about it for 10 seconds, why anybody would romanticize suffering and subsistence farming is kind of ridiculous. Because
yeah, I have no desire to go back.
That's what, like, what is there? There's this guy, I was listening to a podcast the other day, but he has coined this phrase, luxury beliefs, right? And it's like, yeah, only people sitting here in the modern era who know they can take antibiotics when they get sick and who know they're probably not going to die in childbirth and who can get in the car and go to the grocery store at any moment of any day, you know, could sit and have luxury beliefs about living some grimy little life in the year 1000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My wife asked me to please stop saying this, but I have, I'll repeat it one last time.
Between you
I
say, and me.
I don't want to go back to the past, because if you just look at my track record for getting married and having kids, my first son would have, and ex-wife would have died in childbirth, because there was a challenge where, you know, her water broke, but then his head got lodged in the area. So it blocked all that. So it got infected. They both ran a fever. Baby would have died. She would have died. It would have been game over.
Yep.
They got pumped full of antibiotics. He got pulled out. He got treated, you know, so it was, you know, they had a crash cart. It was a whole thing. Right. So, you know, knock on wood, we're good. Right. Because we live today.
Right. Exactly.
Even 50 years ago, that could have gone very badly for everyone. So that's just to give some perspective. And then number two, again, I both my sons had very large heads. So number two, also got trapped in the birth canal. He got stuck on the pelvic bone. You can actually see a little divot on his thing where he got, it's going away, but yeah, at first you could see the divot where he got stuck, and they had to do an emergency C-section. Even 50 years ago, that could have been. So I'm shooting 0 for 2 right now, right?
Yeah.
So in the Viking age, I would be looking for wife number 3 and still have no children. I'm 36, and like you said, my expiration date is 40. Like, I've got very little time. Right? So that is not a great position to be in. In the modern era, I have 2 kids, 2 beautiful sons. My wife is alive, which is great for me. And I'm not going to die in 4 years. I don't think. I mean, the insurance company doesn't think so. So my life insurance company thinks I'll live to the ripe old age, a ripe old age, or at least past there when they cover me. And so yeah, things are really good. And at what am I, 36? 36, at 36 years old, if I need to, I can literally restart my life.
Yeah.
Because it's my, what is it? From 8, so you say you start your working career at 18. Well, although I didn't, because I went to school till I was 23. So call it 23, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been in the workforce 13 years. Think about that. And what's the retirement age? 65.
Mm-hmm.
So I still have double what I've put into the into my working life left to work.
Yeah.
Right. At 36, the Viking age, it's sunset time, right? Like guys are looking at me and they go, he's old, you know? And I'm like, I'm old for a reason, boy. And I can feel it. My back seized last week. I was bedridden last weekend because I had my back had what is it? My lower back muscles.
Spasm.
Yeah. Full blown spasm. I'm just dead. I was just for 2 days just laid out. And you know, in the Viking age, that was a death sentence.
Right. They'd be like getting little antlers and carving some runes and laying it on your back. And like,
oh yeah. By Sunday, they would have had the burial mound dug out.
Yeah.
They're already pulling in the ship. They're like, there he goes. He's done.
Yeah. I mean, so what, I don't know. What is it to, everyone always thinks that it's going to be simpler. Although I will say probably the aspect that maybe is simpler and would be more desirable, you know, when we look around at how, you know, at least in American culture, just, you know, how kind of frenetic and neurotic and anxious, you know, things are, and, you know, kind of fear-based and what have you. And I was just listening to another podcast of actually two different authors writing books about sort of the Gen Z and how they're basically like the most anxious, you know, it's generation that has ever existed. And it's kind of like, why, you know? So this is kind of like the problems of the decadence of a modern life where we've got all these distractions and all these other kinds of things in our lives that maybe make us, you know, kind of fractured and you know, depressed or whatever. Whereas I would imagine that there's an argument for like, look, if when you got up every day, what you had to like focus on was just like staying alive that day, making sure you find enough food, you know, there are tasks at hand, right? And you can't just sort of, you know, get on your phone and look at social media and get depressed and then sort of wallow in your depression, you know? I think that there's something maybe to that that I would prefer.
Yeah, I am subscribed to Arnold's Pump Club. Arnold's Pump Club. So Arnold Schwarzenegger
has a
daily newsletter.
Oh wow.
Of course he doesn't write the whole thing, but he has a great team, and the information they put out is no frills, no BS, just here's some cool research that's come out, you know, and I'm always dubious because when somebody reports on a single study that just came out reporting this result, I think, well, has it been replicated and has it been peer reviewed and has it had that, you know, I kind of get into those weeds. But he had one that came out the other day, and it was actually a meta study, which you're usually a little bit better to report on, because that means that they've taken multiple studies that have replicated the same results and they kind of put together a conclusion. And they had a study recently that came out that contradicts a lot of the work that was done in the late 20th century. Think Ernest Becker with his death anxiety research that he did, talking about how people who are reminded of their mortality tend to take greater risks, tend to act more impulsively, as you know, and it kind of goes down the line. This research actually has come out to show that people who are reminded of their own death more frequently suffer less from anxiety and depression.
Vikings.
And the mechanics of it, how they explain that, you know, because then I click and read the study. And then of course the abstract was a lot more complicated than how they boiled it down in the article. But there is, I mean, I think there's the methodology seemed pretty solid. I'd like to see it the next iteration, which is to see some of the peer review, some of the replications, etc. But in general, it made sense to me that if you think about, and I think the way that they worded it is, if you think about death, not reminded of your own mortality, but if you think about death more often, you're happier because you value the time presented before you more. At least that's what they were implying. I thought that was really interesting. So yeah, I've heard it called the comfort crisis, where we're all too comfortable, so we're all anxious and depressed and everything. And of course, there's a great book by Dr. Anna Lemke, The Dopamine Dopamine Nation.
Right.
And the response is, if you can create pain in your life, that actually helps you reset that balance, right?
Yeah.
And so all this, I think, to your point, maybe this, I think you're onto something, Terry, because this is makes sense in my head, where this desire to go back to subsistence farming might right. almost be a subconscious signaling from people's psyches saying, you're too comfortable, get off your butt and do something. And so that, but instead of actually getting up and doing something, they fantasize about living back in a bygone era that was really, really hard.
Right? Yeah. Like instead of just going, the whole, well, it, yeah, actually I have that on my refrigerator. I may have told you that before. It's like a quote from a guy who started this series of marathons that are really difficult, but it's like, we need challenge to be happy. We need things to be hard, right? Student or students, humans, some of which happen to be my students. We are born sort of problem solvers, and you know, we're not meant to just sort of be sitting passively in a chair, you know, watching time go by. I mean, there's plenty of science behind how not good that is for you. And so we need to get out and engage with the world and get out of our own heads, basically. And so I think you're right. And I think it's one of the parallels that, even though it's, you know, fraught with all kinds of whatever from a historian standpoint, but still, the parallels that sometimes people draw between, you know, the ending of the Roman Empire and, you know, like kind of where we are now, where it's like, you just get too comfortable, like you said, you know, and you lose the edge, right? I mean, and we've said this before, right? I mean, you always want to be the underdog in the sports, right? You always want to be, you know, as soon, everybody wants to get to the top and be the champion, but as soon as you're there, then what? Then you got nothing, there's nowhere else left to go. And then everybody else wants to knock you off and all of that kind of stuff. And so it's like the way up is always the best, because that's about the struggle, and, you know, and it keeps you focused on stuff. That's actually more positive, not focusing on, like, you know, navel gazing and sort of, you know, driving yourself crazy, you know, ruminating on your, you know, mental state or whatever. It keeps you focused on externalities, which I think are better for you.
Yeah, I think that's one side of the coin. My journey of late has been to balance being and doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a place for both. So yes, yeah. Sitting still for too long is bad, but there is a place for sitting still and taking in the experience around us quietly. Yeah. You know, I think that it was Mr. Rogers had a great interview with Charlie Rose. I listened to it the other day, and he talks about, you know, the world is noisy. We would do well with a little more silence,
right?
A little more quietness. And I agree with that, because the world is busy and it's loud. At the same time, you know, too much of that, you know, so there's a balance to be struck, because then you can go, then there's the other side, like you said, there's the doing. There has to have, you have to have some kind of critical action in the world to feel useful. I think that at the end of the day, that's what we're all going for, is we just want to feel useful.
Yeah.
But too much doing also is problematic. Then you string yourself out, you burn out, right? So coming back to that balance between being and doing is really important. That's something I'm trying to strike at, you know, at the ripe old age of 36. I'm not good at it. I definitely swing toward the doing side.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just the whole like rigmarole, the hamster, the proverbial hamster wheel, if you will.
Yeah.
And then if I'm able to come back and recenter. So there's two sides to that coin, where there's a balance to be struck. You know, interestingly enough, because they didn't have screens, because they didn't have access to the distractions that we have, I feel like Vikings would have had a good general, and I could be totally off with this, and this is a total generalization and it's total conjecture, but I feel like Viking Age Scandinavians, and indeed any historical people before, say, the 19th century, anyone who's rural, kind of out in the middle of nowhere, subsistence farming or living off the land, would have had a better balance of the doing and the being.
Yeah.
Because you don't have those distractions, so you would have spent a lot of time in quiet places.
Right.
And being comfortable, they would have needed to be comfortable with that. It would have been part of their existence. That would have been normal. To us, there's so much noise, we're never quiet. So as soon as it's quiet, we feel uncomfortable because we're so overstimulated. For them, right, that would have been natural. And then moving into, to again, the action piece of it, because they're in that quiet all the time, then very naturally they could move into the doing as soon as they figured out something, you know, worth doing. And of course, because of subsistence, and you don't want to die,
right?
Then you have to take action. There is an imperative there. Whereas today, we don't have to do either. I feel like so many people are stuck in the cycle where not only are they not being and enjoying the quiet and engaging with the world with that fundamental experience. What is it? It was Alan Watts calls it the non-distinction, just being part, right? We're not apart from the world. We are the world. We're in the world. We're of the world, right? So just that, you know, you can't do that because it's too loud, it's too noisy, it's too distracting. But also a lot of people are stuck doom scrolling on social media, doing nothing. So they're not actually doing anything. So they have the double-edged sword of discomfort hitting them where they can't be comfortable being and they can't do anything. And no wonder they're like, we're driving ourselves crazy in that environment. Completely nuts.
Yeah, and I'm interested in the intersection between actually being and doing, you know, because I've talked before about, you know, my graduate work in like medieval monastic life. And to me, you know, because they very much looked at the, you know, the various things that they needed to do in order to survive as meditation, you know, it's like work as a form of prayer. And so I'm very interested in the meditative qualities of the doing. And you can imagine that some woman, you know, during the Viking age, who's like weaving or something, right? And you're just sort of kind of doing this sort of repetitive task. I mean, you are active, but it's got this kind of sort of silent meditative quality to it on some level. I don't know.
Well, and today we have an opportunity in our culture because it's one of those things that's pushed on us a lot. But something that I've practiced that was recommended to me, walking meditations, just going for a walk.
Yeah.
But while you're walking, instead of trying to stay stuck in thinking patterns, take in, kind of absorb the world around you, the sounds, the sights, the feelings, you know, take in all five senses and really focus on those while you're walking and focus on each step, step one, step two, you know, and just kind of that repetitive motion. And there's kind of that, so it's like working, I mean, and you can do that with a job, right? If you have, my wife's been rewatching The Big Bang Theory, and there's a great, she just has it on, you know, cause she takes care of the babies and does all the house chores and stuff. And she likes to keep it on in the background. And we just saw the episode where Sheldon can't figure out this complex mathematical problem. So he decides that he needs to do menial labor to distract himself.
Get out of his head.
to get out of his head in order to unlock the answer. And then he goes, of course, and goes to the employment office and totally insults the lady. And I mean, it's a whole thing, but it's funny because that is, I think intrinsically, we all understand that that works. So that intersection, I love what you said, that there's that balance to be struck between the doing and the being. And also, they don't have to be exclusive from each other because there are things that we can do where we can do both. And going back to the Vikings, because this is Vikingology saga, so I don't want to get too philosophical, but that's something I've, like the boat builders, or, you know, just anybody who's working in that environment, I think would have had access to that, would have spent a significant portion of their day in that intersection. And that's something we don't have, or that we struggle with today, because we're bombarded all day with everything.
Yeah, well, and I think the time factor that you just mentioned, they would spend a significant part of their day. I mean, they're living in literally the 3-mile-an-hour world. Like everything just takes longer, and you have to be able to sit with that. I mean, they didn't have to be able to sit with that. We would have to get used to the fact that you can't just go like this. You can't just take a pill and, you know, instantly feel better or whatever. We were so much into instant gratification and having things play out in a much faster time span, that I think there would be like a detox, you know, sort of decompression period if you got transported back then, of just sort of settling into the actual rhythm of life, which is much slower in those times.
Yeah, which back then was kind of forced on you because it was just a feature of life. Now it's something we have to consciously engage in.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say forced on you, though. I mean, when you're born into it, it's just the ecosystem you're in. You don't see it as a thing. It's just, there's not even really an alternative, right? So it's not relative to anything. It just is. This is the world we inhabit, right? So,
Very
yeah.
Fair.
Yeah. Yeah. And if maybe that's it for us too. I mean, we can do that now. We can, because for them, look at, you know, when you're talking about how other people's in the past looked at the past. I mean, if you're a Viking and you're going to like look at the Romans that lived several centuries before them, I mean, but, you know, for the most part, the kind of life is not going to be that different. Whereas for us who live in the modern world could look back at these other times and it's markedly different, you know? So that, I think that's what's different about us. And, you know, maybe why we're attracted to that stuff.
Well, this has been an interesting rabbit hole.
It's very philosophical. We're the philosophical.
Did we start with a topic? Did we start today with a topic? I'm off topic. We just
Viking washing.
But yeah, this all is quite pertinent to the Viking washing topic, right? Because we are talking. Here are the challenges we have today. I think we pinned it. I think we, you know, that's yeah. There's a subconscious yearning for I think that way of being that we don't have that isn't a fact of life anymore, as you mentioned, right? And so we have to consciously engage in it, right? And maybe that's, you know, we engage with stories in order to make sense of the world around us. History is a story, and it's, I think there is a co-opting of Viking history as a story to help make sense of the challenges that we have today. So that's probably where these folks who are Viking washing are going.
That's your TED Talk, buddy. Vikings as a vehicle for coping with modern life.
I think we did it. Yeah, that's right. That's how we engage with the past. Why do we engage with the past? Because, yeah, stories are how we make sense of the world. And then right. Why the Viking? But then we have to say, like, why the Vikings in particular? I think there's still some room for exploring that question.
Well, I'm gonna go back to, like, you know, all of the myth making that happened in the 19th century. What nation state can you think of was looking to the Visigoths to create their national myth? Nobody. I don't know.
The Germans kind of were Visigoths, you know. They were. Why would we look at them as a barbarian? Why are my Germans Norwegian? Sorry, no. Why would we look at them as a people when it's us?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It's like the French. Oh, I get so many funny looks when I remind people that, you know, this. I always like to say that the French and the Germans are very close.
Yeah.
They'll go, no, they, you know, because they, as countries, they fought in the 20th century with disastrous consequences for both sides.
Right.
I think the French took the brunt of that, though. But I always like to remind people, like, no, I, you know, culturally, they're, and attitude wise toward their outlook toward the world, they're very similar. And I think that all has its roots with the idea that France gets its name from a Germanic tribe, the Franks. Right. People go, what? You know, and. What do you mean? Yeah, we're talking about, you know, oranges and a little bit more sour oranges. And I have a friend who makes fun of me. He always goes, you're such a pessimist. You're so French. And I joke because I think the French can be pessimist or pessimistic. I think they're more realist than anything. I was like, yeah but have you ever sat down with a German? Because I had a friend who once told me, he goes, yeah, going out for a beer with my friends in Germany isn't as fun as here in the US because we go out, we talk politics, realize that the world is doomed and go home depressed.
That seems a very Germanic way of thinking. Yes, exactly.
And the French get a little bit of that. So yeah, I don't know. I have a good, oh, the Germans, it is such a fascinating culture. And, yeah, I was a little bit of a Germanophile back in the day, and I really enjoyed studying German, like even before, you know, modern Germany, but like older German history.
Yeah,
there's some fascinating stuff there.
There's actually a good book that I had to read when I was in grad school. I think it was Patrick Geary, who's like, I have a quote of his on my wall over here. It's called Before France and Germany, which is sort of the, you know, the lead up to sort of the creation of those places, which was it was really interesting. I would recommend that. Medieval history. Yeah. But
yeah. Yeah. Cause it's cause it was a very active area.
Yeah.
All through the medieval period, you know, and I think the focus gets taken away from them because, you know, you had England and France that were, you know, in the world heavyweight title boxing match, basically until like 1940, And so you just and I think the Germans kind of got left out of the picture there for a while, and then they show up just like, oh, by the way, we're more competent than everybody, you're all gonna die. My favorite thing, this has nothing to do with Viking history, but I'm just riffing at this point, and these rabbit holes are fun. But I this is why I love history, because the fact can be stranger than fiction. And when you realize that the entire 20th century, actually the late 19th and entire 20th century, the biggest thorn in France's side was Germany. Only to realize that the only reason there was a German unification was because when Napoleon invaded Eastern Europe, he created the same departments that he did in France to reorganize the government, that then created a demarcated unification path for Germany, which then his grandson brought about, Napoleon Philippe brought about through the Franco-Prussian War. And you just go, wow. Talk
You
about
know,
signing your own funeral papers, right?
well, but it didn't hurt that I actually used to teach this, and I thought, you know, and I'm not a modernist like that much. And again, I loathe the 19th century, just for to go on the record. But Otto von Bismarck is a very important statesman in that whole thing, you know, and he the French fall for it, you know, he goes and picks a fight with them and you know, tries to place relatives of the Prussians on the throne in Spain and like basically surrounding France on both sides. It's kind of like, oh,
Yes, that. And my oversimplification does take away a bit of agency from Otto von Bismarck, who was a central character. Yes, he was instrumental. Still, the blueprint to do what he did
Right.
was
They picked
because of
the
Napoleon.
French. Well, I mean, it's one of those great examples in history too of I mean, Bismarck's unification. He had issues with the northern parts, like the Prussian parts of what is now Germany, right, being Protestant Prussians, and then the southern parts, you know, being these various different, you know, communities, whether they're Hessians or Saxons or whatever. But they were largely Catholic, kind of more aligned with the Austrians. But anyway, that like if he wanted to create a modern, you know, unified Germany, he had to get these two groups of people together. Well, what's the great way to do that? Get them both to hate France. So it was like everybody's like, all right, well, we're on board with that. We'll all be German then, if it means we're not French and we can defeat them in the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah. And then they didn't even bother to stay. They're just like, nope, that's fine. We took you out, and now we're unified and we're happy, and you know, the French can keep France. That is another fascinating story of Talleyrand, who's the advisor to Napoleon. You know, I feel like the new Napoleon movie was they missed so many opportunities. So
I
many
agree.
opportunities.
Yeah, I
But
agree.
that Talleyrand is such an interesting character. They could almost make a movie out of him. But you know, the best diplomat I think that France ever had, I think the world has ever seen. I mean, the guy could sell ice to an Eskimo for real. Like he was. And after Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo, and all the allies came together to figure out how to split up France, and he went, and Talleyrand showed up uninvited. He showed up uninvited and made his meetings with everybody, and pitted them all against each other. You know, you go to the Prussians and say, do you really envision a future where half of France is under British control on land, on your border? And then, oh no, I don't know. And then go to the English. Do you really imagine a future where the Austrians control this whole part of France, the textile industry? Oh no, we can't have that. You know, and by the end, they all agreed to leave France alone. And you're like, oh, I can't believe. Anyway, that's history is so much fun. And then that was, who was it? It was somebody mentioned the way that they described Talleyrand. My dad brings up that quote a lot, but I can't remember the quote exactly. It's basically about how venomous he was. You know, I'll have to look it up. But great story. I mean, really, really funny. I mean, I think, like, in retrospect, I look back and I can enjoy the humor of it, kind of the absurdity of the whole situation. Back then, they probably weren't laughing. I mean, Talleyrand laughed all the way to the bank, but is it?
Yes, well, that's the other thing too. The whole hindsight is 2020 with history, right? Because
Yeah.
we know how it turned out, where that's, the other fun part, especially with something like the Viking Age, because it's so long ago. How do you really get into the headspace of those people who are living through a moment that, they don't know how it's going to turn out, so they're just seizing the day. To me that's like super interesting. Like, I wonder how things are going to turn out for us. I wonder what historians in 500 years are going to be saying about this moment in time.
I wonder if there will be historians in
Yeah.
500 years.
Or anything else, but for that matter, other than
Yeah.
that.
Was as I did a I did a so I hired a business coach for my business that I have in it, and they were going through and doing kind of this interview, and they're like, if money were no object, what is it that you would dedicate your life to? And I said, I think the first thing is public service, because I think that's really important. I can't afford to be a public servant. That's a sad thing to say, but that's,
Right.
you kind of have to be independently wealthy
Yeah, you
to
do.
jump, to throw your hat in the ring.
Yeah.
So I said, I think public service is where I would head. And specifically what I would want to do is I would want to champion an investment fund to invest in those technologies that are going to help humanity develop an artificial ecology that would then separate us from the natural order of things, so that we don't go extinct like every single species that ever graced the earth before us. And the guy just looks at me and goes, dude, that's scary. What's wrong with you? I was like, well, it's true. Like,
To
we
live in the
talk, because we
bubble.
do, we keep talking about the future is in, like, will we still be here? Well, if we want to still be here, we have to remove ourselves from the natural order of things, because whether it's in 500 years or 1,000 or 2,000, we know cyclically throughout all of Earth's history, life has gone through major extinction events where anything bigger
Right.
than a gnat doesn't make it. So there's, and we're smart enough to know that. So then we should know that we can only be part of the natural order of things so long. That's why in the Star Trek universe, you have the whole, they know how to control the planet.
Oh.
So we,
All right.
I'm being beckoned. We have a 10:30 appointment. So,
Okay. Well, we can edit that out.
did we talk about what we were supposed to talk about on this episode? Do we need to
Yeah.
do a part
Yeah,
two?
we did, because I had looked at that reel and just sort of wanted your thoughts about just that, our whole romanticizing the Vikings.
Yeah.
And then we talked about France and Otto von Bismarck.
I was accused the other day of being tangential.
Oh, well, that's okay. I always preface my classes with, you ask me a question, I want you to ask me questions. I may go off on a tangent. It may seem unrelated, but just let me go and I promise I'll come back.
Yeah.
I'll bring it full circle and make it make sense at some point, but it just may take me a while to get there.
Yep, that's exactly what I do.
We're the
Yep.
same person, CJ.
Yeah, sometimes, like, reading your article yesterday, was it? Yeah, it was yesterday you put it out,
The
right?
historian brain one.
Yeah, and I was reading through it, and I was just like, geez, like, we like think in the same way. Sometimes it's scary. We have the same birthday, we're in the same state, we have the same interests, and then you write an article, I'm like, I feel like I could have written this. Oh boy.
Ah, well, that's nice to know that there's always someone in the world who will understand you.
Yeah, like-minded people. There's always somebody, right? Well, out of 8 billion.
Hey, that's like the Norns fated it, right? This is the
Yeah.
cosmic, the fact that our atoms are here together, tripping on each other.
Yes, in the words of Brian Cox, are exceptionally specific organization of atoms.
Yes, exactly. Brian Cox, the Scottish guy.
Or, yeah, Brian Cox. No, sorry, not, he said, oh, what did he
Brian
say? It
Green?
was
Brian.
complex. It's, yeah, a complex organization of atoms.
You mean Brian Cox, the Scottish actor?
No, Brian Cox, the astronomer who also used to
Oh.
be a rock star.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like literally used to be a rock star, then became a PhD astrophysicist. Yeah. I'm trying to remember what he said exactly. What is it? We're is it that we're a complex organization of atoms?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. I don't know. It's if you're listening to this, correct me in the comment section.
Exactly. If you're still listening at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, until next time on Vikingology.
Until the next time, until the next tangent.
Yes, exactly. More to come.